The Guardian.
According to the stats, I think you've won 7 golds yourself.
That's right, yeah.
4 silvers.
Yep, I think so.
Sure. Yeah, so it's always been a championship that you've personally done particularly well in.
Well, it's the first couple of years, or the first 3 years, were kind of like a learning process, and I wasn't full time at that stage. But really, from 1999 onwards, it's been fairly successful. Can't complain.
Sure. And I think there's a quote back in 2004, and you said no one has ever won 4 World Championship golds before. Was that individual?
They'd won. I don't know what that quote was from. I think that might have been referring to the kilo.
Oh, fine.
No one had ever won 5 before.
Fine.
4, there'd been myself, Arnaud Tourneau, and Lothar Toms, the German rider, had won 4 kilo world titles, but
sure.
No one ever won 5 before.
And do you feel a little ambivalent that the kilo is no longer, obviously, an Olympic discipline, and so you won't be doing it?
That's the main reason. I mean, it's not an Olympic event, and therefore, you know, I had to really focus on my best chances of getting a gold medal in Beijing, and unfortunately that meant dropping the kilo, because I'd love to still ride it, but you know, it's just not a priority anymore.
As I was saying earlier, you know, as a not a cycling specialist, but just as a normal sports fan, the kilo seemed to have sort of quite a symbolic power to it, you know, the distance, and also the fact that it was so demanding. It wasn't a sprint exactly, but you were going full hell for leather and so demanding.
Yeah.
Do you feel it's cycling has maybe missed something in axing it as a Olympics?
Definitely. Particularly from the public's perspective, the perception of the sport. You know, if you switch on the Olympics as a non-cyclist and saw the kilo, you could understand it straight away. It's very straightforward, and it's exciting, and it tends to build to a crescendo towards the end as the times get faster and faster. And there are a lot of events which in cycling which you do need to have a bit of a knowledge about just to follow what's going on. So it's, I think, from the powers that be, I think it was a mistake to drop an event that is so, you know, easily understood and, you know, and exciting and a sort of showcase event for the sport. And it is a race of truth, if you like, because the fastest rider wins it. There's no interpretation of tactics or you know, there's no luck or kind of you know, lottery element to it, which some of the events do have. But then that's what makes other events exciting too. I mean, like the Kieran is exciting because of its unpredictable nature and because of the potential for spectacular crashes and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's swings and roundabouts, but the kilo was an event which was a kind of one of the blue ribbon events, along with the sprint maybe.
And just, I think, the whole psychology of it. And I think, was it when you won Olympic gold, were you the last cyclist out?
Yes, last to go.
The whole psychology of you to see what other, and I think the Olympics record was shattered three times before.
So
for you to face those kind of demons adds to the...
Well, it does. It's not just a test of physical strength. It's about the mental, you know, the concentration, the focus, and just seeing the riders put under that kind of pressure. Quite often they do crack, and that's what's interesting about it. It's not predictable in terms of, you know, on paper, the world champion or the fastest ranked rider should win it, but it doesn't always work that way because of the essentially goalposts could be moved right before you race, you know, literally seconds before you race. Someone could break the world record or push the bar up really, really high. And you have to deal with that mentally and concentrate and basically put that aside and just focus on your event. So, you know, for so many reasons, I did really enjoy riding the kilo. It was a painful event, you know, there's nothing else like that, that kind of lactic acid burn you got in the last lap and a half. I don't miss that part of it.
So after how many metres?
After about 600 metres, you'd really start to feel it. You know, the last lap, it looks as if you're putting lots of effort in, but really, your legs have almost seized up by that point, and your momentum's carrying you through, and you're just trying to hang on. It's a pretty grim event, and it's not like an evenly paced effort. You're really putting a disproportionate amount of effort in the first lap just to get up to speed, and then your kind of speed just slowly drops off and drops off.
We won't talk about kilo much more because obviously your focus is elsewhere, but if you could just think back to winning that Olympic gold, I think afterwards you felt a lot of emotion, didn't you?
Yeah, it's the pinnacle of most athletes' careers to become an Olympic champion, and there was so much build up to it. And just the nature of the Olympics, it's a real pressure cooker once you get into the village and once you experience that Olympic environment.
You've got knocked off on your back as well.
Just
to add to that.
Lots of little problems, and just it was such a long year building up to it, and I just wanted it so much. You know, it was such a big deal for me, and to finally achieve something that you just don't know if it's possible or not. On paper, yes, you should be able to do it. It's the same ride as you've beaten before, but it's the Olympics. You know, it's a special event. You know, it's not every year you get a chance to win an Olympic gold medal. So, you know, it was just such a big build-up to it, and to finally achieve it, you're in shock, and you're kind of, it's disbelief for the first few seconds. It's just that this is real and it has happened. And you know, every other event, as soon as you cross the line and you win, you're celebrating and it's great.
But that's elation.
The Olympics is just it was so different. I just kind of rode around in disbelief for a few seconds, and it did take a short while for it to sink in. And even then, it was just, you know, relief and disbelief more than anything, just that the pressure was over and I hadn't, you know, made a mistake, and I, you know, done exactly what I wanted to do, and I'd done the best ride of my life, you know, when it counted. And that was just fantastic.
And there were a few tears then, as was it just that feeling all that you had done it when it mattered most?
Yeah, absolutely, because, well, you know, it turns out that was the only opportunity in my life to win an Olympic kilo gold medal. You know, at that time I didn't realise that, but you know, you don't get many opportunities in your life to win an Olympic gold medal. So when you do, you want to make sure you take them, and you not just for yourself, but for all the people that have helped you along the way. And there's so many people that go into making an Olympic gold medalist. It's not just about the rider's performance of the night. There's countless people that have been influential and significant in that performance. So for them as much as for yourself, you've just done them justice, and you've done all that build up and all that you know, invested time. It's made it worthwhile.
And I know that there were petitions pleading that the kilo could be kept. Do you think there's a way that it can maybe come back for 2012? Or
I don't know, really. I think it's down to the kind of powers that be. When you look at other sports, this seems to be a bit of you know, inequality between the sports. You look at swimming, for example. They've been allowed to introduce open water swimming for the first time, but not had to remove any events. And I think they've got something like 34 medal events, which seems unbelievable. You know, to have that number of competitors and events and not have to remove one for a new event to come in, it seems really unfair. For cycling, we've had to pay the price. We have to take out an event which, first of all, isn't going to reduce competitor numbers, which is the whole point of what they're trying to do to sort of cap the Olympics, to stop them from growing. So we've lost an event which is a showcase for the sport, and you know, it's not as if we have to build a new facility or a different venue. It's just literally a set of medals and an hour of competition.
So it seems daft, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And winning the Olympic gold, obviously you had to shake lots of hands and you had to do lots of things immediately afterwards. But would you say your life changed in any way?
It did change in terms of just the kind of demands that are placed on you out with your sport. Up until that point, you're pretty much training, sleeping, eating, and you know, that's what you do, that's it. As soon as you become an Olympic champion, you have countless things that are, you know, put in your path to do, or that you have to encounter, you know, just various other responsibilities which you hadn't really experienced before. In a minority sport like cycling, you know, it's a fairly obscure sport, you're not in the public eye that much. But once you become an Olympic champion, it wouldn't matter what sport you're in. If you're an Olympic champion, it's a universally recognised thing, so people, you know, they want to speak to you, they want to know your opinion on things, they want to, you know, meet you, whatever. And you have responsibilities to sponsors, to all kinds of things, and it does take up a lot of your time, and that it's a very hard thing. And I think nothing really prepares you for that, and there isn't anybody really there to, you know, you just have to try and go through it yourself and try and, you know, deal with it the best way you can. But it does make it difficult initially when you try and get back into training and you've got all these things on your plate.
But on the other hand, you know, your dedication is so deep and your commitment to your sport matches most other sporting disciplines, and yet cycling doesn't always get, and as you say, you don't particularly want to have publicity impinging on your work, but you don't get the plaudits that other sports people sometimes get.
No, you don't. I mean, cycling's a huge sport in Europe, but the roadside of cycling is huge. You know, track cycling is the kind of poor relation, but ultimately, you know, you get accolades for being in a sport that's popular, and you know, if you're in football, if you played football, or if you were a Formula One driver, or you know, athletics, that kind of thing. then more people do it, more people are interested in it, and therefore it's only natural that more people are going to be interested in you if you're successful in that sport. I didn't take up cycling to become famous or rich or anything. You know, it's a hobby essentially to start off with, and I feel fortunate that I'm able to do a job which, you know, I genuinely enjoy, and there's not many people can get out of bed every morning and say they genuinely enjoy what they do. So, you know, anything that comes with it, any additional benefit, is I see that as a bonus, really.
And with your catalogue of getting knocked over on bikes, obviously you Manchester police car knocked you down.
Yeah, police van. Yeah.
Did the guy sort of, when you got up, and or if you hopefully you got up quickly? I mean, did he know? Oh, I've just knocked down an Olympic gold medalist.
No,
I guess
no idea.
Not.
And he was. He wasn't. He was. He sort of. He did apologise, but he was just a bit. You know, he was almost. He was almost laughing. Actually, I think he was laughing at the irony of the fact that he'd, you know, caused an accident, basically. But I wasn't really seeing the funny side of it at the time. Just because my whole Olympic dream just kind of flashed before my eyes at that point. You know, it was only a couple of months out from the Olympics.
So this was just before 2000.
This was before 2004.
Gosh, so you got knocked over twice.
Yeah. Well, this was about a mile from here. About 2 months before. It was the actual. Bump was nothing, it was literally a little knock, but it's only because he braked just in time, and it's the kind of, I was coming towards the junction, he was coming the opposite way, and he turned right in front of me at this crossroads, and it just, there was nothing else there, there was no one, I don't know how he couldn't have seen me, but at the very last second he jumped on the brakes and the van just sort of went, stopped, and I just grazed the front of the car, of the van, and that was it.
Did he subsequently work out that, you know?
I don't know, no idea, I screamed at him for about 5 minutes, and once I calmed down, you know, it was okay. But but yeah, you know, I had a little bump last week, or this week actually, on Tuesday.
On your back?
Yeah, I had a blowout, back tire blowout in training, just at the end of an effort I'd done. I was just doing a motor paced effort, so I was up to about 80 kilometres an hour, and then finished the effort, was riding around, slowing down, so I was probably doing about 40, so I'd slowed right down to that point, back tire blew out, and just straight down. So if it happened about 10 seconds earlier, it would have been, you know, could have been disastrous. Yeah. But
we'll take that as a good omen.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, who knows, fingers crossed.
Yeah. And could you explain, for me and also people who are not cycling experts, about the Kirin? Obviously, we know the bike starts and then it peels away. Yeah. Could you just explain the technicalities and tactically how you handle an event like this?
Well, personally, I try to control the race and try to, you know, dictate the way that it goes. I found that if I just wait to react to other riders, then, you know, I get stuck in the pack, and then, you know, I don't do so well. So for me, it's about using my strength from the kilometre as my kind of asset, really, trying to go a little bit earlier, take the pace straight away, try and pick it up and try and string it out, so that the sort of true sprinters aren't able to kind of, you know, control it the way they'd like to. So it's all about getting the pace up as fast as I can and just try and control it. And if you can let one or two guys go in front and use them as a kind of carrot, if you like, but you don't want to be any more than maybe second or third. If you're further back, further towards the back, then you get a chance of getting bogged down and involved in all kinds of problems.
But I saw, I think, was it in Holland earlier this year, because obviously you were known for always, as you explained now, dictating, but I think, was it Holland earlier this year, you were quite further back?
In Rotterdam, yeah. Well, the Rotterdam, it's like a six-day race, which is a kind of more entertainment race, really. So, it's about trying to get the pace up and try and control it from the front. You know, you don't want to be. I mean, the problem is that once you start doing that all the time, then your competitors know what your tactics are going to be. But having said that, there's one thing knowing what your competitors are going to do, and another being able to stop them from doing it. So, you know, they do know that I'm going to try and go early. But it's not that easy to stop somebody. If they really want to do it, then it's not easy to prevent them from doing that.
And what is the actual distance? Apologies.
Well, the actual race starts 2.5 laps from the end, and it's an 8-lap race in total, but the first 5.5 are behind the motorbike. Yeah. So that's what, about 620 odd metres. It's a, you know, a 2.5 lap race, really. The bike swings out of the way. Traditionally, it wouldn't be a kind of race from the gun. You know, usually there's a bit of looking and watching, and then it builds up, and about maybe a lap and a half to go, that's when it really kicks off.
And obviously you won gold in this last year in the World Championships and in the Kilo. Which out of the two do you feel you're better at, and just if enjoy, I don't know, it's not adjective, but
I enjoy them both for different reasons. The Kieran, it's a different kind of feeling when you win it. It's a kind of man-on-man race, you know, it's beating somebody, you're actually racing against somebody else, whereas in the Kilo you're really racing against the clock, you're racing, testing yourself, and obviously you're racing against other competitors, but it's a different kind of mentality. It's more of a kind of, I don't know, a battle when you're in the queue, and it's more of a man-on-man physical battle, and it can be quite physical as well, just in terms of the bumping and barging. But they're both, you know, great events. I really do enjoy, but they're so very different in terms of the mentality that goes into it. But physically, they're actually quite similar in terms of the physiology you require for both events. They're both extended sprints, and so I think that's probably why that it's been a fairly smooth transition into the queuing.
And does sort of psychology come into it, that you sort of can outpsych an opponent?
Yeah, you can. You know, there is a lot of psychology in terms of pre-race, getting yourself psyched up, but also trying to just impose yourself on that race and trying to dominate. And if you can help yourself in advance before the race even starts, then that's great. You know, if you can, I think you really, it's not so much about, you know, doing the old track and field, you know, 100 meter guys walking, strutting about. It's not like that.
Yeah.
It's more about letting your legs do the talking in terms of showing your strength on the track. You know, if you can consistently perform at a high level, then the other guys are going to have that little bit more, you know, not fear, but, you know, concern that, you know, that if they don't stop you, then you know you're going to run away with it, basically. So it's about letting yourself show yourself on the track. That's the important thing.
And the pain, nowhere near as bad as the...
No, it's a shorter event. You know, the real part of the race only lasts about maybe 35 seconds, so it's just before that real nastiness kicks in. You know, the last bend, you're starting to feel it and you're hanging on, but it's nothing like the kilo in terms of you're not getting helped off the bike at the end, you know, where your legs are buckling underneath you. So it's different that way.
And I'm sure you would have expected to have won it last year at the World Champs, but certainly in the newspaper, seemed some of the Dutch, maybe Theo, people were a bit surprised that you actually...
Well, I was surprised myself.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, it was because it's such a new event to me. I didn't really expect to win it. I didn't really have any specific objectives in terms of my finishing position. I just went there to race and gain experience, see how I could get on.
So how many had you done before the World Cup?
I'd raced the World Cup in LA, and I'd raced the Japanese queuing here at the World Cup, which is an additional event, just a prize money event. So it was just those two events.
And had you won
them? I'd won them both, but it was, you know, at that stage it was still fairly new. So I knew I knew I was capable of beating everybody, but I hadn't actually raced Taylor yet in a final. So it was, you know, he was the favourite anyway as defending champion. And yeah, it was just, you know, the whole week, when apart from losing the team sprint by 2/1000th of a second, it was almost the perfect week. You know, it just seemed to hit a real purple patch of form, and it was great. But the Kieran final was fantastic. You know, it's an event which I used to sit and watch in the stands and look forward to, because it's always spectacular, and it's I think it's one of the highlights of the week, or the 5 days of racing at World Championships. You know, it's always an event which is unpredictable, so you know you don't know what's going to happen. But just to be there for the first time in 12 World Championships, and never raced the Kieran final before, so to be there and be involved in it was great, and to win it was, you know.
So the feelings afterwards, was that pure elation?
You said
the Olympics was more sort of just...
There was no relief, because there was no real pressure, and there was nothing to lose.
So where's this time? I guess there is, because you're defending...
Well, I don't really feel it so much in the World Championships, because the main objective this year is the Olympics, and I've already qualified for the Olympics by being World Cup overall winner. So again, I feel I've got nothing to lose and everything to gain. It's just an opportunity to win in front of a home crowd, and to, you know, I've never done that before, never had a World Championship win in Manchester, so I think it's a big opportunity rather than a pressure situation, because it's an event that's so unpredictable that you can't go in as favourite. You know, on paper you can be a favourite, but you know, you can never be assured of victory.
So do you think for Beijing you'll be in even better shape?
Yes, certainly hope so. I mean, I'm going very well just now, but I will be in the best form of my life in Beijing, that's for sure.
And how many guys out there are going to be battling it out with you for gold? Sort of, obviously they all want to win, but realistically, how many
in the Kieran?
Yeah,
probably about 5 or 6, I would think, are a realistic gold medal. You know, you wouldn't be surprised if they won a gold medal.
And who, just if you could?
Tail Boss, Arnaud Tournant, Kevin Ciro, both French, Michael Bourgain, he's French as well, and probably potentially Ryan Bailey, although he's a bit of a wild card. He was Olympic champion in that event in Athens, but he's not really shown much form since then. But he's a guy you can never discount, but he potentially could be back to his best form by then. Mm.
And, you know, when you start, because you, I know it's your birthday on Sunday?
23rd, I don't know what day it'll be.
What's today?
You say it's 23rd, yeah. So Sunday.
Yeah. Shows how excited you are about your birthday.
Yeah, I really celebrate them.
Because you're turning what?
32.
32, yeah. I actually had in the categories, I had a list of people who turn their birthdays on. There's some good people. Oh, right. Damon Oldman, because I know you like music.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Atherton, Roger Bass, obviously, former Mark Jerkel, Zergy, Michael Nardin. Another Olympic
Marty Pellow.
well, kind of. Yeah. There's always going to be a
Steve Regri.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't know that.
So you know, it's quite a good little.
That's a nice little group.
And I see they put you first. So this was last year. So
nice one.
So you obviously birthday's just not on the agenda this year. You're gonna.
No, they tend to fall during the World Championships. You know, every the last 3 or 4 years. Anyway, I've been away for my birthday. Mm. So it's not really a big deal to me.
But if you think back 10, 12 years ago when you were starting, obviously it was much more of an amateur level then, but cycling in the UK was just not doing much, was it? Had no facilities, no money. So, can you just sort of explain to people, because now obviously things are booming and this nation's perhaps the best in the world. Mm-hmm. Could you just compare to how it was when you started?
Well, you couldn't really have a bigger contrast between the World Championships here in 96 compared to now in 2008. So 12 years has made, you know, it's almost unbelievable what's happened in terms of the transformation of the team. When I first raced here, you had your own bike. You know, they gave you a set of wheels to race with. That was the kind of the only equipment you had from the Federation. You had two skin suits to race in for the week. No other kit, no, you know, road jerseys or, you know, tracksuit, no tracksuit. No t-shirts.
So you just turn up
in your jeans and your own t-shirt, and you had your two skin suits for the week, and that had to do for warming up, for racing, all that kind of stuff. I was at university. Most guys had full-time jobs and just kind of fitted in their cycling around it. And we just got the velodrome here, so we did have a year-round facility, but 2 years before that, you know, we had to train from April till September, and then you'd be on the road or indoors on a static trainer, you know, for the winter months, because you couldn't get access to an outdoor facility. And it was, you know, there was no wonder that we weren't able to compete with the top countries at that time. You know, now we've got the best coaching set up. We've got the money came on board from the lottery, and that allowed us to sort of take the first step up. And then the problem was the chicken and the egg. You had to get results in order to get funding. And thankfully we had a couple of individuals, Chris Boardman, Graham O'Bree, Bevon McGregor, who were performing at the world, you know, the top of the world level, and that kind of guaranteed funding.
So I know you were, obviously you did your BSc, and so I guess you were a student some of those years, but how did you survive financially?
I had to move home. I was initially at St Andrews University, and then I moved back to Edinburgh, so I just stayed at my parents' house, used their car to drive up and down to Manchester, you know, just support from my family basically. You know, at that time I had a part-time job, and I was studying.
What sort of job were you doing?
I was working in a bookshop at that time.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not too bad, I guess.
Keep your feet up, Nothing too physically demanding. Yeah.
And when did things start getting slightly easier financially that you could...
I think after 99, once we got secured A-level funding, after winning the silver medal at the World Championships in Berlin, that was when we still, you know, it was enough to live off, basically. It meant I could be independent from my parents. I didn't have to scrounge off them. And that was the start, really.
Last two things. 2012, you'll be 36. So is that sort of enticing
you?
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, it's always been the plan to go into London, maybe even Glasgow in 2014. Who knows? But at the moment, I'm focused to keep going to London, and we'll see how it goes up.
And just in terms of the physicality of the events, like the Kieran, 36 is still feasible if you obviously.
Well, I mean, there's lots of guys on the British team, for example, but Jamie Staff, 35, Jason Queeley's 38, Craig's 34, 35, so it's, you know, there's plenty of guys in the mid-30s. Bruno Risi, he's 40, he's world champion. Juan Linares, he's 39, and he's world champion as well. So there's guys in their late 30s still performing at the top.
The final thing is, you know, obviously you seem particularly laid back and amiable sort of person, but obviously a sprinter has a kind of certain psychology. Mm-hmm. Can you explain, because I guess you've got that. Because
some people have to display it all the time. You know, you see a lot of the sort of boxers and the track and field sprinters that are continually talking and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And, whether that's just the nature of the sport or that's, you know, it's become that way over the years, I don't know. But in cycling, there's very few guys like that because you look like an idiot if you do all the talking and you get to the track and you don't win. So, you know, I'm very much of the opinion that you let your legs do the talking. And you have a switch inside your head that when you get on that bike and you swing your leg over the bike and you've got a number on your back, then it all changes. You know, you can be as friendly and relaxed as you like up until that point, but when you get on the track, that's when it changes.
And in other aspects of your life, do you have that kind of competitive, intense...
I'm a bit competitive, and it's something I try and battle when I'm not in a situation that I need to, you know, I have to win at everything, and it's a bit embarrassing. I hope I'm not going to be one of these competitive dads when I'm out.
Do you have kids?
No, I don't.
So by then, hopefully, you've got it all out.
Yeah, exactly. Get out on the track.
Can I just ask, have you got a girlfriend?
Yeah, I've got a girlfriend.
How long have you got?
A couple of years now.
Oh, fine. Yeah. Sure. So you won't let her beat you at anything? No?
Yeah, absolutely. Very competitive.
Anyway, I would love to talk more. It's a pity we've got
to end now.
Anyway, Christian, good luck.
Thank you very much.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.